final investigator I met with was Dr. Ruben Nizvitsky to discuss multiple myeloma, and he began by commenting on work he just presented at ASH, the so-called upfront study.
It has been long recognized that patients with myeloma who are in the non-transplant group, otherwise the patients who are elderly or have comorbidities that they don't allow them to proceed with stem cell transplant, have worse prognosis. So this study was looking particularly at a novel approach of bortezomib-containing induction regimen followed by a bortezomib-containing maintenance regimen. This is the first time such an approach was done in the elderly patients. So the goals of the study were actually to compare three different form of induction regimens. One, bortezomib, melphalan, and prednisone, long considered to be the standard of care based on the VISTA study run by the San Miguel group and all the Europeans published in Lancet. Then the bortezomib thalidomide dexamethasone, also designed and run in the younger population by the Italians, and of course bortezomib and dexamethasone, which was the most common used regimen here in the States. So the goals were to identify the regimen who will provide a longer progression-free survival. And of course, as secondary endpoints were to look at response rates, quality of life, and toxicity. After a prolonged phase of induction with these regimens, the treatment was then followed by a maintenance program, which was given to everybody. It was given at a weekly bortezomib at 1.6 milligrams per meter square, which was also novel in the definition. At the beginning of the design of the trial, it was attempted to drop one of the arms. We were trying to identify which were one of the best two arms, and we enjoyed the being monitored by an independent monitoring committee who, after the first and then the second meeting, did not identify a winner in either of the three groups, and therefore recommended to continue the trial for completion. And so forth, we already completed the accrual of the trial, and we are following the patients closely.
Is this a phase 3 study?
It's a phase 3 study, yeah.
What was the age of the patients in the study?
So it was patients 65 years or older, as they're not candidates for stem cell transplant. But of course, there were some patients who their treating physicians did not identify them as transplant candidates, and therefore they were younger. But the median age was, I cannot tell you the data exactly now, but it would be around 70. And we have a 20% to 30% population who were older than 75 and even some older than 80. So we have a very significant representation of very elderly patients with myeloma. And also, given the nature of the cooperative group that we used, there was a lot of community-based practice patients, and therefore we had a larger minority representation as well.
Can you talk a little bit about what was seen in terms of side effects and toxicity, particularly neurotoxicity?
So neuropathy was one of the major toxicities that we were closely scrutinizing, and that was because it had been recognized one of the most important toxicities of the bortezomib-containing regimens, and since we had one in combination with thalidomide, we were particularly interested to see what the difference is. And in fact, the neurotoxicity was one of the most common seen in the three groups, interestingly lesser in the bortezomib-dexamethasone, and to more extent in the bortezomib thalidomide and dexamethasone. The impression or the final gestalt was that overall the responses were higher on the bortezomib thalidomide and dexamethasone when you compare to melphalan, prednisone, bortezomib or bortezomib dexamethasone, but certainly there was no statistical significance to make that difference. In terms of progression-free survival, we did not see any difference in the three groups, but I have to caution you that we don't have enough events and the follow-up is still early. So we're very eagerly waiting for new updated data sets. Perhaps we're going to have an update in ASCO and in the upcoming ASH for the following year.
Were you able to look specifically at the patients over age 75 and see how they tolerated and responded to therapy compared to the younger ones?
Yeah, the response was similar. I don't remember seeing a large difference in the response. I don't recall seeing a major challenge in treating the elderly patients when you compare to the youngest one of the groups.
Sort of globally, at this point, what's the message that's coming out from this data?
Well, so far, the most interesting observation is that the group of bortezomib and dexamethasone is performing as well as the other two groups. So you would ask, at least in this elderly population, you might really don't need three agents. You might succeed with two agents only. We have the same efficacy and perhaps lesser toxicity.
Can you talk a little bit about how you approach this decision outside a protocol setting, a patient in their 70s who's not a candidate in your eyes for a transplant? I know there are a lot of things that you factor in. What are the things that you consider, and what are the regimens that you utilize?
Let's just start with saying that the elderly population, the standard of care before these trials were designed, were either methylprednisone, and thalidomide. And based on that randomized trial, the most commonly used in Europe was methylprednisone and thalidomide. In the United States, methylprednisone never reached the place as a priority in treatment, and therefore many people were using MPT, methylprednisone, thalidomide. It was my impression, however, that in the elderly group of patients, thalidomide was usually poorly tolerated in that causes constipation, lethargy, cognitive abnormalities, and of course the thrombosis, the constipation that are more marked in the elderly population. So usually there was a high degree of discontinuation or abandonment of the drug, reaching 40% to 50%, and so the impact of the combination of thalidomide was not great, at least in our population of patients. So the addition of bortezomib to methylprednisolone and prednisone was always attractive. And so I have always used methylprednisolone and bortezomib as one of my first choices in patients of advanced age. Of course, there are certain nuances that one has to remember in this group. Is the patient able to come to the office to get the bortezomib? Is the patient able to do this type of biweekly schedule? And of course, one of the benefits of using the bortezomib that is important in the elderly people is that most of these patients have some nephropathy to start with. And melphalan is difficult to give in patients with nephropathy. It's difficult to titer the doses depending on the cytopenias. And the same you can say about lenalidomide, which may be challenging to give in patients who have renal dysfunction. And therefore, methylprednisolone and bortezomib, or at least a bortezomib-containing regimen, is attractive. Ideally, I would have liked to have a fourth arm, which would look at lenalidomide dexamethasone in the lower dexamethasone arm, because that's mostly what we all practice in the United States. And yes, lenalidomide at appropriate doses with a lower dose of dexamethasone seems to be another excellent regimen for this group of patients.
And we've done patterns of care studies of oncologists in the United States and know those are the two regimens that are commonly utilized in the non-transplant situation. How do you approach duration of therapy and maintenance in the non-transplant situation?
The data of maintenance, it's really unexplored in the elderly population. And that is because since the data of alpha interferon, continuous therapy with alkylators was always not accepted because of the high incidence of secondary malignancies. And therefore, it wasn't until recently that we have shown that the chronic use of therapy may improve the outcomes, particularly our observation that in the BIRD trial in which we combine lenalidomide, clarithromycin, and dexamethasone, although you may at cycle 8, cycle 9 drop the steroids or drop the clarithromycin, you will continue the lenalidomide, you may accrue responses and maintain the responses through more than 5 years and increase the response rates as you continue with the therapy. So that's an observation that's been universally accepted, that the chronic use of lenalidomide in this particular setting, it will not only improve the responses, but also maintain the responses for a hopefully a longer survival. the initial approach with bortezomib was different. The goal with bortezomib was achieve a maximum response as soon as possible and as robust as possible to later allow the patient to maintain off therapy, to offer the patient a disease-free and drug-free interval, which also was an acceptable option. But given the strong data from the VISTA, and now present the maintenance trial by Dr. Sonneveld, there is a shift on that philosophy, and maintaining the patients with bortezomib would be also an approach which was largely untested. So in the elderly population, I have induced with any agent. I am now trending to continue therapy throughout, particularly if I'm using lenalidomide and I have not accrued enough toxicity. And the same I can say about bortezomib. If I achieve a good induction therapy, I might reduce the dose, increase the gap in between doses, but I try to maintain some form of therapy throughout.
What do we know right now about the schedule of bortezomib in neuropathy, and how do you apply that in your own practice?
Unfortunately, a weekly schedule was never tested in a prospective intent-to-treat approach. The efficacy of bortezomib was based in its irreversibility of the inhibition of the proteasome, and therefore it was always accepted that a repeating dose per week was the optimal way of giving the dose. And of course, that accrued 30 to 40% of neuropathy, 10% severe neuropathy, and therefore those modifications had to be ensued. Was after the observation of Dr. Palumbo in a trial in which compared VMP versus VMPT, that interrupting the dose and then changing to a weekly schedule will allow the patients to maintain a similar dose intensity of the bortezomib, reducing significantly the toxicity, obtaining very similar results in terms of complete response and overall response rate. And therefore, there has been a shift on the use of bortezomib. But I remind you that it's only been tested in the combination setting. It has never been tested in the single agent or in combination with dexamethasone. And therefore, you ask me what is my approach. I might initiate in the elderly patient, maybe patient with a high risk of developing neuropathy or so. I would initiate a higher dose or the standard dose of days 1, 4, 8, and 11 for a couple of cycles, and then if the response has been satisfactory, then move rapidly to a weekly schedule.
How do you approach dose modification when you do see signs of neuropathy? What kind of symptoms or problems will cause you to change it?
Well, certainly neuropathy is the number one toxicity that will motivate the dose modification, and there's a package insert that identifies the dose reductions. But basically, my practice is that the patients develop pain with neuropathy or more than grade 1, I will hold the dose until the neuropathy improves, and then I would move to the lower dose, exactly as the package insert. If the response has been satisfactory and I think that I have more than a 50% drop on the paraprotein and that's a solid response, I would not hesitate to change it to a weekly schedule. But I would not initiate yet my therapies at a weekly schedule unless in very particular cases.
I want to ask you for your thoughts about some of the other new research developments that are important in the field. But before I do, maybe we can talk a little bit about induction and long-term plan in the transplant setting, how you approach that, and what are some of the new data sets that you think are important for oncologists to know about in that scenario?
Well, I don't think there is a controversy anymore, both in the transplant and the non-transplant setting, that achieving a complete remission is one of the most important goals that will reflect later in long-term survival and long-term progression-free survival. So I think the use of the novel agents, either in a concomitant approach or rather a consecutive approach, either way can achieve overall response rates reaching 90%. And now, with all the newer combinations, I think the bar for complete response should be 40%. And I would reject any other type of regimen that would not give you at least 40% of complete responses. in that context, the use of lenalidomide and dexamethasone with clarithromycin, the way that we do it, yields more than 90% the overall response rate with 40% CR rate, almost 70% more than a VGPR. And those are the points that we have to always keep in mind. As similar results are when you use the combination of lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, as pioneered by the Dana-Farber group, and it's been very popular in all the oncology in the United States, given that they're different class of agents and the schema of treatment is pretty easy to give. Perhaps more toxic that use it in a sequential fashion in which you can start with lenalidomide and dexamethasone and then followed by bortezomib and dexamethasone or in other type of consecutive sequential approaches just before the stem cell collection. We try to achieve the maximum response possible before stem cell collection, and that differs from our colleagues in the Mayo Clinic and also in the Dana-Farber, in which they usually collect after the third or fourth cycle of therapy. And I don't think there is one data favoring the other. It's just a matter of style. Until we have developed adequate techniques for minimal residual disease, we won't be able to settle these differences. The truth of the matter is the use of lenalidomide in chronic fashion won't allow us to obtain stem cell collections with GCSF alone, and therefore, if you're going to use lenalidomide in a chronic phase for more than a year or so, to collect stem cells, you have to introduce a chemotherapy-containing mobilization regimen, such as cyclophosphamide followed by GCSF, or plerixafor and GCSF. But that being said, once the stem cells are collected, I sit with the patient and I say, well, you have achieved a maximum response. We have already your stem cells collected. You may want to proceed with stem cell transplant and serve it as a consolidation or just cryopreserve and hold. It was easy in the past to say, well, if you want a disease-free, drug-free interval, you might as well do a transplant after achieving the maximum response, serve that as your consolidation treatment, and then follow up without maintenance. But now, with the novel data that is coming out from CALGB and from the French group, I think is still controversial, but most of the people are talking about continuing in maintenance.
And you're talking specifically about lenalidomide.
Correct.
You mentioned that there are a number of options for induction in the pre-transplant setting. What's the one that you'd use the most?
So we use lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and clarithromycin. And once that's achieved a maximum response, if it's not a CR or a VGPR, then we add bortezomib to the regimen, either just in combination with lenalidomide or in combination with the cyclophosphamide and dexamethasone in the cyborg type of approach. Another approach would just also be consolidate with bortezomib and Doxil, which is also a good regimen as a consolidation. Another induction regimen that I favor is cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone as the cyborg regimen. So those are the three major, lenalidomide, clarithromycin, and dexamethasone, VRD, or the cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, dexamethasone. I'm participating in a clinical trial of an oral proteasome inhibitor in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. That's another frontline, very interesting frontline trial. And of course, we all heard in ASH the great results of the combination of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, also a very promising frontline treatment.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking that that might turn out to be the new RVD. What did you think about that data set? Of course, it was just, I guess, phase 1-2.
Right. So it's the same as the RVD, first being reported as 100% response rate, and then when more patients were accrued, the numbers had to be. But what is very significant is the reduction in the neuropathy and the potential for long-term use of this drug.
You mentioned carfilzomib, and you know I've heard about the issue of maybe having less neuropathy, but with that paper by Kubiak, even though sort of indirect comparison, it really seemed pretty significant. When you look at all the data we have right now on this agent, that as well as in the relapse setting, what's your take in terms of risk neuropathy as well as efficacy of this agent, for example, compared to bortezomib?
Yeah, I don't think I'm prepared to compare bortezomib to carfilzomib in the terms of efficacy outside of the context of a clinical trial. And I do need a clinical trial to tell you, because the populations were very different when they're comparing one against the other. The only thing I can say, I do have a lot of experience using bortezomib, and I have gained significant experience with using carfilzomib, and I'm very encouraged by use of carfilzomib in terms of the lack of emerging neuropathy or minimal neuropathy in some patients. I can just remember one or two patients developing emerging neuropathy in that case. Challenges, of course, occur with carfilzomib, and I think the most important is just the double dose required, consecutive dosing from 24 hours apart, which that makes it challenging to certain patients to come back to the office 2 different days. So both drugs will be developed, and then we're going to have oral proteasome inhibitors in both camps, and I'm also looking forward to see the development of those oral agents.
Another agent, I guess, not maybe second, actually, I guess you could say third generation agent in the IMID class is pomalidomide. What do we know about that?
Well, pomalidomide actually is not new. In fact, was around before the development of lenalidomide. It was, I think, just random that lenalidomide was developed before. But we do have 2 early trials done in Britain which show promising results with what is now pomalidomide. Now, pomalidomide has excellent toxicity profile with lesser neuropathy, minimal thrombogenicity, and also improves responses when paired with dexamethasone. So it's the new agent. It has the ability to overcome resistance to lenalidomide or thalidomide. And we are actually running a trial right now with pomalidomide, clarithromycin, and dexamethasone in patients who are either refractory to or resistant to lenalidomide and also resistant to proteasome inhibitors. And we have seen very interesting responses. We have at least accrued about 2 complete remissions and several VGPRs. So we're really encouraged about the use of this drug, not only because of its efficacy, but also because of its high level of tolerability.
I'm sure you see, as referrals, many patients who've been treated in the community-based setting before they got to you. Are there any things that you see doctors in community-based practice doing that maybe they could do better? You know, things that you say, well, I'm not sure why they're doing that.
I see overuse of non-steroidals in myeloma who can put in jeopardy the renal function. It used to be the overuse of alkylating agents and the use of vincristine and adriamycin, which has been really significantly decreased.
You know, I don't remember anybody mentioning the non-steroidals to me before. That's really interesting. What do we know about that?
You know, patients that overuse non-steroidals have a higher incidence of renal dysfunction and interstitial kidney disease. And particularly myeloma patients with light chain disease have a higher incidence of this dysfunction. I mean, I always try to take care of the kidney as one of the most important things in patients with multiple myeloma, because once a patient becomes end-stage renal disease, the mortality increases significantly, the quality of life decreases significantly. So I try to make a lot of emphasis on how you can be renal protective in your patients, and of course avoid IV contrast, non-steroidals, antibiotics such as aminoglucosides, encourage hydration, and of course follow the creatinine when using bisphosphonates.
You mentioned bisphosphonates and the question, I guess, of duration. How do you approach that issue?
One thing is what the guidelines say, and the guidelines are unfortunately limited because of the lack of prospective trials. And they're being just done by consensus of experts and based only on data available from the older clinical trials. So, for instance, the length, it has been said that just for 2 years, because after 2 years there is no data. And the world of bisphosphonates has been shaken now after the trial presented by Dr. Morgan, in which the use of bisphosphonates, particularly zoledronic acid, will prolong the survival of patients. And therefore, maybe there is going to be a shift on the use of bisphosphonates now. In the past, we used to say forever. Then we changed to until we achieve maximum response and then do it every 6 months. And now we're back to monthly, maybe every 3 months until progression of disease. It's unfortunately an unanswered question. There's a lot of style issues. In general, when I have a patient in complete remission, in a very stable, with good prognosis, without major bone disease, I tend to increase the gaps in between the administration of bisphosphonate. I will generally give it for a year and then increase it to every 6 months or a year. That's my personal particular way of doing it. I don't know if that's the correct way of doing it.
How do you approach the issue of cytogenetic profiling, risk profiling, and how does it affect what you do?
Certainly, I evaluate every one of my patients with both FISH and conventional cytogenetics. Only in the context of clinical trials, I'll obtain extra marrow for gene array if that's necessary, but it's certainly not my major approach. Those patients who have deletion 17, 414 or 1416, I will plan to definitively use a continuous therapy type of approach. In other words, if it's a younger patient, not only stop with the transplant, but continuing with some form of combined maintenance using lenalidomide and intermittently proteasome inhibitors. But I have to say, appropriate approach, again, has not been tested prospectively. So we do know that bortezomib might be a little bit more effective in those patients with higher risk, particularly 17P and 414 or 1416, but the deletion 17 patients will remain as bad actors. So we certainly are looking for novel approaches in those group of patients. Fortunately, that's the minority of the patients, and the great majority have 1114 or hyperdiploid who can follow the same algorithm. If you ask me which the treatment approaches are very different, I don't think we can make huge differences, but maybe the major difference in those high risk is the maintenance and continuous therapy with bortezomib cutaneous regimen.